Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the program host, guests, and participants, and not necessarily those of KKRN Community Radio and Acorn Community Enterprises, or the underwriters of this station. Hello, and welcome to Dig This Trump Watch with host Professor Parker Pollack. Hello, Professor Pollack.
Hi, Pamela.
Trump Watch airs the first Saturday of each month at 9 a.m. I am Pamela Spoto, and I will be joining in the discussion with Professor Pollack. And I want to say, while I have the opportunity, that we're going to be having a pledge drive coming up soon. Please stay tuned for that. We are listener-supported. We are all volunteers. We need your support to stay on the air. Thank you. So once again, Professor Pollack, we have a lot to talk about. And some of the items that you may touch on today are President Trump stumbling into trade wars, military wars, domestic wars here at home. And as time allows, I really like this part, we will continue the hot pursuit of when America used to be great, but alas, is no longer great in Trump's view. So, Professor Pollack, I think we should just get started.
Okay, Pamela. Well, we've over the last several months, on occasions, we've used the word stumbling in reference to President Trump's moving from topic to topic or issue to issue. And I think it, I don't mean to denigrate the man, but the word stumbling implies lack of control, which I think we have some evidence to suggest that that's one of the characteristics. And mostly, I think people have noticed the difference between this president and prior presidents in that he's gone astray from the standard norms and the customs of the office of the president. I've been watching the president closely over the last 13 terms or 50-some years, and I have to say the people that have a hunch that President Trump walks all over, stumbles all over the norms and customs of the office, I think they're on the right track. That's not too far astray.
Professor Pollack, do you think that some people obviously his supporters really like that, though, because he's going against the norms, and whatever that means, it doesn't matter what norms he's breaking, that mm-hmm. just the fact that he's different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a big part of why he was attractive to a little over a fourth of the eligible voters. And in surveys since the November election, that population has been studied. they're probably getting tired of being studied. But it seems that they were people with lives that were characterized by disillusion, that they had dreams that didn't seem to be possible for fulfillment for themselves or their children, their grandchildren, their parents. Even members of their community. One great example of that is a little town on the shores of Lake Erie. Port Clinton, actually, is the name of the town.
Interesting.
Interesting, right. But there was a fellow from there. In fact, if you look up on the internet, if you Google in Port Clinton, Ohio, study of, you'll come up with this fellow, Roger Robert Haddock, or a name like that. Anyway, it was his hometown, and he graduated from high school there in 1959. And over the years, he didn't get a chance to go back much, but he did back in about 1980, late 80s or something, and he was just stunned. That portion of the town where he grew up, shuttered storefronts, factories closed, people wandering without purpose, young people without a future, teenage pregnancy rate through the ceiling, that's kind of an interesting characteristic of one of the consequences of disillusion. Now I'm playing sidewalk psychologist, I know, but it strikes me that if you have a future that's characterized by disillusion or lack of purpose, it may be living for the moment is the driving force in your life. Anyway, Port Clinton, Ohio is just a classic example of people who may be going through this now in a third generation without purpose, without a clear positive view of what does the future hold for my folks, me, my kids, my grandkids. And when you start getting to people's families and the effects of lack of programs, lack of effort on the part of one level of government or the other, you start to generate voters for a presidential candidate who is going to smack at the system every time he gets a chance, and that's going to make them feel like, this is the guy, this is the guy.
You know, and I wholeheartedly agree with that. And unfortunately, rather than looking at the systemic problems of why that happens, you know, decade after decade, it's so much easier to scapegoat, you know, scapegoat immigrants, scapegoat the labor, the union people, scapegoat other countries. It's an amazing, amazing thing, and very unfortunate. And I think that that's what's happening too. It's always somebody else's fault. I mean, and Trump does initiate that too, the finger pointing.
Oh yeah. Well, the idea of the immigration restrictions, he was barking up the wrong tree if he's trying to suggest that the lack of jobs here are due in part to immigrants taking them. The stats don't back that up. And in fact, if you wanted to argue about the loss of jobs here, those good-paying jobs, I mean, right here locally in Redding, Humboldt County, Shasta County, Southern Oregon, logging communities, especially after World War II, the boom in building was great. The jobs were great. These were men and women who had a high school diploma, or maybe not, but they were working in sawmills. And I have some personal experience because I also was working at a sawmill as a fledgling college student. But these were people with middle class living. My partner, he and I were loading cars for Arcata Redwood. He had a house in Eureka. He was making house payments. He had an old clunky pickup, but his wife had a nice car. They had a baby. They were living the middle class dream, and he had a diploma from Eureka High School, but Humboldt State College was right across the bay, and he chose not to go. So, the absence of some of those jobs certainly were due to manufacturing concerns that relocated to another country like Mexico or China. But when you look at the statistics about what's happened to jobs in America, boy, it's hard to argue that more than 15% of the job loss here is due to shipping the jobs overseas. We lost the jobs due to automation. Technically, or, you know, changing the production process over to robots. If you wanted to take a look at how Toyotas and Chevrolets are made today, if you compared that to the way they were assembled in 1950, we wouldn't even recognize the assembly line.
And I'm not sure that we touched on that in the past. We might have, but I've been hearing more and more about that, the robotic culture, and it would appear that that is a trend that is going to continue. And the people that speak of that in a very positive way suggest, well, that will just free up time for the population without, you know, considering what we're talking about here. What about the jobs? Then how do people get the money in order to pay their bills, their mortgage, take care of their family, and so forth? And once again, just because we can do something, does that mean that we should, you know, become more and more robotic? And so that goes back to what, you know, we were just talking about. So it's so much easier to point the finger and blame the immigrants. Let's build the wall, when indeed that has not been the problem. A lot of people aren't aware of that. And I'm not sure that how they become aware of it, because now the current saying is fake news, can't believe that. I know it's the immigrants, you know. So it doesn't matter. Sometimes facts don't seem to matter these days, and that's a scary thought, too.
Well, there's, let's see, I'm not quite sure how many years ago, but I think it was probably about 20 years ago, 25 years ago, a fellow who was teaching political science at a community college in New Jersey was curious about why his students, when presented with the facts on different political issues that were brought up in class, didn't seem to have any impact on the way they answered essay questions that he would pose to them on exams. It was as though the information, they talked about it in class, they read the same articles, they had lively discussions, but on test day, nothing. So he started looking into the brain, essentially.
right.
And he found out some very interesting things. We don't have a lot of time here, but just the one thing that always stuck with me is the brain has a tendency to reject anything that's confrontational to material that's already been stored. And I've noticed that, of course, you probably have too in your students over the years, or in yourself and myself, I've seen it. If our listeners would like to look up that article, it was in the Journal of Developmental Education in the spring of 91 or the spring of 92, and the title of the article, oh boy, get my Rolodex out here, the title of the article was Thinking as an Unnatural Act, and it was a great way to describe the article that he wrote. So
maybe just the last thing I want to comment about this, because I know there are plenty of things that you have to inform us with today, is that this seems to be such an incredible issue, because I keep shaking my head when I listen to people talk, let's say, that are scapegoating, for example, because I'm thinking, with more information, why aren't they taking that in and changing that position? But from what you said right here, the brain I guess a person would have to really want to make some mental changes in how they see the world. That worldview can become crystallized, I think.
Well, one of the things that popped up, among my students in my classes, was the idea that I shouldn't have them be reading stuff that is just from, like, major sources, that some of the more mainstream magazines, that they should read some of that stuff. And if I always recommended to them, if they, not that it was relevant to test or anything, but if you want to keep up with what the liberals are thinking, then read The Nation magazine, read The Progressive, read Mother Jones. If you want to keep up with the conservatives, what they're up to, read the American Conservative, read National Review, read Weekly Standard. Okay. And if you can get a blend of those sources, I think you can eventually get this thing, I'm pointing at my head, get this thing to shape up and let you be in charge rather than it. You can tell I'm a dualist. A lot of people don't agree with that, but my mind and I have arguments. And so I think if I can just bombard it enough, it will lighten up, and I won't react so heavily to information that's contrary to what's there. Yeah, I may go out and buy another motorcycle, but anyway, yeah. So, well, the idea then of the stumbling, we were talking about President Trump stumbling through one issue over another, but there is, well, maybe we should say one more thing. As he switches from topic to topic, various journalists and commentators on the radio and in TV and internet and so forth, the cable news, they've suggested that he lies. You've probably run into the commentary also that he doesn't tell the truth always. And I've made up a list. I don't have time to go through. I've got a list here of, I don't know, 18 or 15 or 20 items where what he said was simply not true. And that when presented with the fact that the stats aren't accurate, he would say it again in the incorrect version the next day at another event. And there's some people at USC, University of Southern California, in the psych department. Last year, they came out with a study. This is a preliminary study on the prefrontal cortex of the brain, the front part over our eyes. That part of the brain is oftentimes referred to as the one that provides us with our executive functions, being able to decide and act on different options. And so the prefrontal cortex is made up of, well, I'm going to act stupid here because I am when it comes to the brain. There's gray and white matter there, and that they've noticed in the studies they did, I think it was over 100 people, 108 people, that those who were habitual liars without remorse had a different percentage of white and gray matter in the prefrontal cortex of their brain. And so for them, lying was easy. But for the most part, people that have another balance, let's say a more balanced a portion of gray and white matter in the prefrontal cortex of the brain, they find telling the truth the easiest thing to say. And the conclusion so far that the USC psych folks have made is that the brain has an easier time, mostly, it has an easier time telling the truth. And when it's asked to lie, for those people who are not habitual liars, when it's asked to lie, it has trouble. It has to work harder, the way they put it. The brain has to work a lot harder in a person who's, quote, normal, whatever that is. It has to work a lot harder to come up with the statement that's not true.
Well, that is really fascinating, because as you were talking about that, I was wondering what comes first, the brain percentage, or let's say a pathological liar or a person that's lying all the time. Is the person lying and not caring about it, or it's easy for that person to do it because of their brain, the white and gray matter? Or is it that percentage changes? See, the more that I do something, the more I lie, and the easier it gets.
Mm-hmm.
And
wow.
So it's a fascinating thing. And so with President Trump, I mean, it's been demonstrated so many untruths that he has told, and he continues to tell them. Faced with the facts, he'll just say, "Oh, that's fake news," and he'll go on with the untruth.
Yeah.
So it's just mystifying.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, that's a great question. I'm sure the people at USC, if they're listening,
and they should be,
they're probably chasing that down. Once we mature, well, there's another part to President Trump's behavior that's tied to prefrontal cortex, and that's the part of the brain that teenagers haven't yet developed very well, and that's why parents of teenagers tear their hair out, because it's the parent is always saying, "What were you thinking?" Well, the heck of it is, the teenager wasn't thinking.
Right, right.
And that's because that part of the brain doesn't really fully develop until we get to be, I don't know, 23, 4, 5, something like that. And it's entirely possible that in some people, there are parts of our bodies that don't develop very well, develop very fully. And should you be an adult that's 70 years old, and your prefrontal cortex has an unusual mixture of gray-white matter, and then is short on the developmental process that should have taken place 35 or 40 years earlier, you may be a person who can't estimate consequences either, which is the teenager problem. He or she didn't know that would happen, because I did this. So at any rate, if you have an adult who can't estimate consequences very well, does things that seem silly or stupid or moronic, to use a current phrase,
yes,
then it could be a person whose behavior is beyond his or her control. The gray-white matter is in the wrong mixture. The developmental of the executive function part of the prefrontal cortex is insufficient. And now you've got a personality that is constantly seeking for adoration. That seems to be the most pleasant thing the brain might enjoy. Any of our brains love to think that we're adored. I do. I just love it. So at any rate, if that's then the major characteristic of the adult is the search for adoration, you have a really interesting human being there. Yeah. So I just thought I'd throw that out. And
I'm glad you did. And maybe in another show we might be able to talk about, well, I don't know if you want to, but I'm thinking about the prison industrial complex. But in the sense of trying children as adults, people will say, well, they know the difference between right or wrong. But this very thing about the development of the prefrontal cortex, the consequences, the lack of reasoning ability in a child before all of that, the formations form, if in fact they do, you know, by a certain, you know, certain age, that we need to revisit, trying children as adults.
Yeah, so. Oh, certainly. And there are, well, the United States and I think it's Zimbabwe are the only two countries that still execute children. There's one more country, I can't remember what it is, but it's from the undeveloped world.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, okay, so we've got the dilemma with trying to follow President Trump in his meanderings through the various demands of his job, and that he seems to stumble into things and doesn't play up to the expectations a lot of us have experienced in other presidents. And again, I say I haven't watched these since I was a kid in high school, of course, but since I was an adult, probably I started watching presidents pretty faithfully, starting with Lyndon Johnson, I think, and because of the war in Vietnam and his lies and so forth. So, but since that time, the presidents since Lyndon Johnson, they've behaved in a certain way. And so, like you say, some of Trump's supporters may like it, the fact that he walks all over the norms and the customs. But in addition, he also apparently still doesn't take the regular intelligence briefings that come every Tuesday, used to come every Tuesday.
What does he need intelligence briefings for?
Well, I think other presidents have used him to figure out what's going on.
Exactly. Yeah. And that goes back to, I think, what you were saying in terms of the brain and adoration, and there's the idea that somehow he is exceptional and he doesn't need that information, you know? Mm-hmm. And while we're at it, I just need to remind the listening audience that this is KKRN Dig This Trump Watch with host Professor Parker Pollack.
Okay, well, thank you, Pamela. And then obviously some of the other customs that, even though past presidents, Reagan and Bush Sr. and Clinton and Bush Jr. and Obama, didn't always like the actions and the statements of leaders of other countries that had been our allies since WW2, the standard is to show public respect to these allies and then work on the differences, you know, under the radar, but show the other parts of the world that the developed countries are in unison on certain basic democratic belief in liberal forms of attitudes towards people rather than very dictatorial, non-liberal attitudes. Western Europe, England, Canada, New Zealand, sorry, Australia, and Australia, Japan, that these countries that place civil rights, human rights, in very high esteem, these countries are unified in how they approach their dealings with themselves and with the rest of the world. That has created, since WW2, some kind of balance. We've avoided WW3 so far, which would probably involve the nuclear weapon. So to shake up that view that the rest of the world has of the developed countries, with the United States playing a leadership role, that has far-reaching consequences, as we've seen. I don't know Turnbull, the fellow from Australia, but to have him treated the way our president treated him, or the lady from Germany.
Merkel.
Yeah. This is just unacceptable. You know.
Well, you know, as you were talking there, I was thinking that, once again, going back to Trump's base, it would appear that these very things are appealing because it shows that no one's going to tell America anything and we don't have to listen to anybody. It doesn't even matter whether it's a third world country or an ally or whatever the case may be. We're going to make our own decisions. We don't need the UN. Who was the fellow, I don't quite remember his name, that said if we just took off the top level of the UN building, you know, that and that would be fine too. You know, it's kind of like, because we're in a position of such power that none of those other countries matter. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. it is amazing to me because mm-hmm. we're not being a very good world citizen mm-hmm. trying to get along with the rest of the world in a collaborative way. And as you said, I mean, at least showing respect for other leaders of the world, especially allies.
Yes.
It just seems that is the right thing to do because mm-hmm. it's the right thing mm-hmm. to do.
Right. Well, and to be a little on the crude side, we need them.
Yes.
Yeah.
John Bolton.
Yeah. There. Oh, yes. Oh.
Yes. Sorry.
Thank
okay.
you. Thank you. Yeah. Undersecretary of State for Bush Jr. Yeah. Anyway, so the idea that our president walks over the customs and all that, the stumbling is shown probably most obviously in his changes in policy. The DACA policy on the children who were brought here by their parents illegally from Mexico and are now adults, that the ball has been tossed to the Congress to do something about making it permanent one way or the other. The president could just go on, as other presidents have done, in 2 year segments. You have to continue to sign up for the program. But a study the other day, can't remember the source of the study, but it's something like 80% of Americans are in favor of leaving these people alone, giving them access, a program, a pathway to citizenship. I mean, some of them are in the Army, our Army. Some of them are, they have jobs, they're in, or they're going to college. The idea to do anything other than is what the American people have shown a true character, I think, in us, in that 80% of us say, leave these people alone, mm-hmm. give them a path to citizenship, the flip-flopping on the policies, that just throws everything in disarray inside the country. And for young people in school, what are they to think? When one day the president will say something and tomorrow he says it completely the opposite.
And there are so many things that he has flip-flopped on from when he was running for president to when he became president, even while president, you know, from LGBTQ rights to these endless wars. No, we're not going to interfere in other countries, saying that torture is okay. I mean, just trying to change and environmental policies that he's just doing away with in terms of regulation. It's really, truly amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. Right. So, and I think I'd like to get to that, too, later in the program. So at any rate, he's had this habit of stumbling around over policies and contradicting his cabinet officials, attacking the court system. I mean, I'm not sure that I haven't seen any evidence on the part of this president that he understands our tripart system of government. You know, we have three branches of government. That the rule of law, not the rule of
Trump.
Oh, yeah, okay. Not the rule of Trump is what governs a country.
Yes.
We have a system
that's
apart from the power of any one person.
Yes.
So I don't see a lot of evidence, if any, that he appreciates or understands that. The people who taught him in college, I'm sure some of them are maybe tearing their hair out over, we'll get to his economic policies and things later too, but at any rate, attacking the court system, the media.
Yes.
If we don't have a media, free media, uncensored media, we might as well pack it up and call this country a fascist. One of the things, Thomas Jefferson, he's one of my favorite guys, he said he would rather live in a country with a free media, regardless of the system of government, than the reverse, that without a free press, we don't have information and we can't govern ourselves anyway.
And right now, I mean, there is a relentless attack on the press, corporate as well as alternative press. And the censorship is incredible. People are mm-hmm. losing jobs. It's and part of it has to do with what? Surveillance or possible, you know, I don't understand it, to tell you the truth. Mm-hmm. But it is relentless.
Yeah, it is. The part of the dilemma, I think, for professional journalists is that they've been trained in a way that makes them like the telephone, which your telephone, my telephone, is non-judgmental. It lets us hear everything that the person who's calling us said. And so they have that sort of an orientation. But like you mentioned, corporate media, as well as, well, I was going to get into the Facebook kind of information.
Yes, the social media, yes.
Social media, very important.
Yes.
And it's difficult for professional journalists to keep their jobs. 80% or 80-some percent of professional journalists work on the two coasts. The West Coast or the East Coast, and that very few journalists have well-paying journalistic-level jobs in the media in between the West Coast and the East Coast, which shows you something. I mean, and even if you take a look at the Reading paper, it's now been bought by USA Today. We had the editor and some of the people that were the journalists there, I thought they were doing a great job, but maybe it came down to dollars and cents.
Well, it's the whole notion of consolidation, you know, in, you know, what you're talking about too, and that to do it the cheapest way, and they're not paying the reporters to go out and dig and take months to come up and interview people and dig into the issues more and then bring that information back to inform the public. It's like this infotainment, as some people call it. You know, let's just have the bells and whistles and entertainment and people yelling at each other and calling people names. It's just, it's really, really incredible.
Right.
We're not getting the information. We're not getting the heart, the meat of the information that we need.
Well, that idea of attacking some of the basic institutions of our culture, the courts and the press are two of them. But then he went ahead and attacked his predecessor. He attacked the foe during the election that he beat in the Electoral College. He's gone after fellow Republicans. Ronald Reagan had a famous 11th commandment: "Thou shall not criticize a fellow Republican." Well, I'm sure the Republican Party is having a difficult time trying to figure out what to do with the fellow who claims to be a Republican. Although I think from 01 to 09, I think he was actually registered Democrat. But anyway, he is.
But to look at what he says now, I mean, it doesn't sound Democratic. It doesn't sound Republican, except far-right Republican, maybe. It's hard to say what he believes because of this total change that he can make from week to week, month to month, day to day. Doesn't matter. And you know, Professor Pollack, we're going to need to take a short break for just a couple of minutes. And to our listening audience, this is KKRN, Dig This Trump Watch with host Professor Pollack. And so we're going to take a short break and listen to, I happen to really like this song, Let's Take Our Heads Out of the Sand. And so here we go.
I had a dream the other night. Now, in my dream, our national bird had become the ostrich. How much can she take? How much can she give? How much is too much?
And welcome back to Dig This Trump Watch with host Professor Parker Pollack. And we're going to continue with our second half.
Alrighty. We were talking in the first half about our use of the word stumbling to describe President Trump's moving from one topic to another, or as one commentator put it last week, moving from one dumpster fire to another, or a flaming issue of some sort, very important issue that distracts us from the prior issues, and so we forget some things and move on to the new things. He does have a really good way of dominating the media. And what it is, it's going to be the latest in the 24-hour or 4-hour cycle, or in his case, it could be a 1-hour cycle. Bob Schaefer has a book out, Rats, can't remember the name of it. Famous journalist from television news. But he describes some things about President Trump as that the news cycle might be 15 minutes. It could be one particular policy in this 15-minute period, and two or three other 15-minute periods later, you might have a change of policy. And so it's very difficult for people to figure out what page we're on in terms of policies for domestic or foreign affairs. And there was a study done by how this affects the public. You know how some universities specialize. Well, like Sonoma State was always well known. I'm not sure today if they may have moved on to something else, but they had projects censored for a long time.
Right, big deal. Was a very big deal.
And then they had the Center of Critical Thinking, internationally renowned Center on Critical Thinking. There's in Connecticut, can't remember the town, Hamden? Anyway, in Connecticut, there's a small university. And I hope I say the name right, Quinnipiac University. Their specialty is polling. They are, by some estimates, they are the gold standard when it comes to doing polls that are accurate. And they have an institute. In fact, it's called the the Quinnipiac University Polling Institute there on campus. And so that's where the study that I'm about to describe, that's where it was done. And so it comes with pretty high marks from, this university gets high marks from everybody from Rupert Murdoch and the Wall Street Journal, all of that, clear over to CNN and MSNBC and all of that, and Fox News included. So what they did, this poll was released about 2 weeks ago. So it's fairly fresh. What they found when they studied, I think it was close to 2,000 people were in this study, this opinion poll. What they found was that the results were well above half, somewhere between 56 and 67% of the people surveyed felt very negatively about the president. That's pretty remarkable. Here's one stat. 59% of them felt that he wasn't honest. 60% said that he had poor leadership skills. He doesn't care about the average American. He's not level-headed. He has no shared values with other Americans. They disapprove of his performance. He's dividing the country. He's an embarrassment. And so when you put these statistics together and you find that there's, 59% felt that they disapproved, 57% disapprove of his performance. And then you find that 56% say that he's not fit to be president. Now, that means 56 is darn near 100% of 57. And so
yes.
98.2% of the people in this survey who felt that he was not, they disapproved of his performance and said that he wasn't fit to be president, that gets real close to the people saying he should be impeached. If
yes.
you're not fit to be president, then the people who hold that attitude probably are going to want to sit down and at least talk about the idea of impeachment. And for some people, impeachment is really, even in the study, they didn't get to that point in the study, but you can imagine that some people who feel very strongly about President Trump and that he's not fit, as these people did, he's not fit to be president, they're looking at who would take his place, and they don't like that option.
Yes.
And so the stumbling would then transfer from the president to the public. Now we will stumble through the rest of the term anyway. So, yeah,
that's not good news.
No. Well, as long as we stay on our toes, you know, and that's the secret with any politician or any corporate leader or even the leader of the Boy Scouts, whatever. Everybody needs the light shined on them. So, at any rate, when you take a look at what people do with these kinds of findings, there's a lady by the name of Tammy Bruce who she was quoted in the September 8th issue of The Week. On page 15, she is commenting when someone asked about President Trump having so much trouble getting anything done, and that at one point, this was a week or maybe 10 days ago, he suggested that if the money for the wall didn't come forward out of Congress, that he was going to shut down the government.
Yes.
And Tammy's response, and I quote her here, what do you expect him to do when all these politicians are, quote, obstructing the will of the people, end quote. Now, this is Tammy Bruce, I don't know, they refer to her as Fox News piece, but she, first of all, regardless of whether Clinton or Trump was in the White House, neither one could argue they have a mandate from the people. One had 27% of the popular vote, one had 28%. I think Clinton had 28% of the popular vote. That's barely one over a fourth, a little bit over one-fourth of the population who's eligible to vote voted for you. And so for you to think that the wall is the will of the people, I think well, I don't know how to address that kind of thinking. She has something in her brain that says it was right, and contrary evidence is going to be rejected.
And that may go back to our previous discussion or earlier discussion in this show about the prefrontal cortex and what is going on there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the reasoning process and the critical thinking skills and the educational level of information coming in.
How much effort do people take to stay informed?
Right.
It's probably easier to stay informed today with the computer and with the social, you know, the news network that's available through the internet. And there are still, you know, if you wander through a bookstore and go to the back area where they have the magazines, there are in the political, economic, social kind of magazines that they have there, there's really quite a selection. And they're not very expensive. So at any rate, if you have the time. Now, if you got a couple of kids and a job and, you know, I can understand. But for the rest of us, i.e. yours truly, it's easy. In fact, I got so used to doing it when I was working that it just, I feel like I am retired, except for going fishing and, you know, all of that.
Right.
So the Quinnipiac University Polling Institute is a place that I'd recommend. If you see some polling results coming out of there, I think you can really be assured that they're accurate and you could use them in some other sorts. If you happen to find yourself on the radio, you could use them there. Well, the stumbling into wars then at home. First of all, we had the president stumbled into the war with the National Football League. Commenting about the people who wanted to take a knee during the playing of the national anthem, and even referring to them as, SOB, the initials, I guess we all know what that means. But that's really unusual for a president to do something like that in public. Now, granted, Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon had language that is regrettable, but not in public. They're on tapes and various things. So, yeah, but this is another way of stepping on the norms and the customs that have created the image of that type of person who's going to be the president of the United States, who occupies the White House. So that idea of trying to control the player's freedom of speech, I'm not sure that so far I haven't seen any evidence that President Trump recognizes that as a key. The key, maybe the key, First Amendment freedom of assembly, of speech, of religion, to gather and protest for address, the grievances. That whole part of our Constitution and the amendments, the Bill of Rights, that number one, the First Amendment, that's the key. I mean, that's been the critical to the civil rights issue, Americans with Disabilities Act, student rights, women's rights, gay rights, labor rights, child rights, animal rights. If you went back to 1880, if your listeners would check out the case of little Mary Ellen McCormick. She was so badly beaten by her drunken mother and bleeding that when she was brought into court, there was no welfare agency to represent the little girl. And the judge cried when she was presented and what to do. And she was represented in court by the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals.
Really?
The SPCA took her case. And that's the height, you know, of how important free speech is. Or a lot of us have probably heard the phrase rule of thumb. People don't use it much anymore, but that phrase comes right out of the courts of America in that period, 1880 or 1890, in that period, a post-Civil War before the turn of the century. And it was a court-decided decision that a man could beat his wife as long as the stick that he used was no wider than his thumb. Thus, women had to be careful. Take a look at your husband's thumb before you get married. Take a look at your boyfriend's thumb, because that's what he can beat you with, a stick that big. So, again, free speech drove that one out of existence, protests about that kind of thing. We have... The idea of players taking a knee in a sport And now maybe it'll be in professional basketball. But there's some racial disharmony that he's generating here. 70% of the guys in the NFL are black. A bit more than that, are black in the National Basketball Association. And so you can't help but to be tapering or walking around the issue of white privilege when you start to engage in a behavior like that as a president. I remember when my first teaching job was in West Pittsburgh, California, the principal of the school decided someday, I'm not sure why, he decided someday, one day, that no longer would the boys in our school be allowed to wear hats. No hats. Well, guess what? Guess who wore the hats? Maybe we had black kids, white kids, Asian kids, whatever. The only kids that wore hats were the black kids. You know, that's one of those cases where, come on now, principal, there's something wrong with that decision. Let's take a look at it. You couldn't talk him out of it. We had police on that campus. This was in the 60s, so there were other issues going on too. But
right. But
another one of those silly, stupid decisions that didn't do anything for racial harmony at all, obviously.
Well, you know, what's particularly interesting about this case with the NFL, and if I understand it correctly, I mean in terms of the football league supposedly now kind of a representation of pro-military or militarization in a sense. And if I recall correctly, it was 2007 when the Department of Defense started paying the NFL to have the young men appear to be more patriotic, because before that, I guess they were staying in their locker rooms during the national anthem. And so millions of dollars were spent to get these young men out, for the national anthem, and it was a kind of a stand, a united for recruitment in a sort of way for the military. And now this has been so distorted in terms of what Kaepernick had his initial attitude about why he was taking a knee, and it was about police brutality, the young black men being killed, as well as justice and equality. And that is, and it's a very prayerful kind of position that he took. And his fellow teammates started doing this as well. And so now it's kind of like this distortion, this misrepresentation, what we would call it in critical thinking, a straw man attack. You take the position that was made, and you distort it, misrepresent it, exaggerate it, and then you attack the distortion. So Trump is saying, these men are not, they're being disrespectful, they're not honoring the anthem, they're not honoring the flag, and this is not what it's about. This mm-hmm. is absolutely mm-hmm. not what it's about. And then he calls them names, they should be fired, and these racial tensions come up. It's really awful about how this has become not what it is mm-hmm. in the public's mm-hmm. eye. Mm-hmm. In some of the public's eye.
Sure, sure. Well, there is, I'm not sure exactly when it was written, but in the NFL rule book on pages 62 and 63, if your listeners are curious about this kind of thing, look up, I think you can find it on the computer. Just type in NFL rule book, pages 62 and 63, and you'll see there are some prohibitions about certain kind of behaviors, and I can't remember whether I think one of the mandates is on those two pages, one of the mandates is that you shall not stay in the locker room, that you'll be on the field for the anthem.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the other part of that paragraph says that in addition you should stand.
Uh-huh.
And so it's in the book. It's okay. Uh-huh. You don't have to stand. You're not violating your employer's, you know. I mean, if I had a cafe, which Lord knows I couldn't manage one, but if I had a cafe and one of my employees showed up in the morning with a T-shirt expressing his belief in atheism, much as I might agree with the sentiment, I can't have him walking around in my restaurant with the people I know, and my income is determined by. Mm-hmm. I have to send him home. It's pretty simple. I can't do it. So the NFL has, they're the employer. And they have all these corporations below them, 32 whatever it is teams, who have separate owners. It's kind of a multinational corporation. But at any rate, they can set up whatever rules they want. And then that fellow that I sent home with his atheist T-shirt, he can decide to work for me or not. That's the libertarian approach to this issue. That it is capitalism, it is for profit, and those things that are going to threaten the profit margin, which the NFL has been suffering some drops in revenue. I'm not sure why, but and so they're probably fairly sensitive to these kinds of things, and so. Yeah.
It is also interesting that that now, as I understand it, or recently, most of the owners who are white and the players black, the owners are standing with mm-hmm. the black players against this administration's denigration of these players and what they're doing. So that is kind of curious too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Well, there are more and more Americans, I think, are reacting to the marches, Charlottesville, Virginia,
right?
Yeah, and that kind of thing. And so the idea of freedom of assembly, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, and et cetera, all First Amendment guarantees, they are tricky. If the American Nazi Party wants to have a meeting somewhere, they're certainly entitled. The American Communist Party wants to have a meeting somewhere. They're certainly entitled to have the meeting someplace. The problem comes up with issues that involve a parade. And so a lot of cities have a permit to have a parade since you're gonna disorient the downtown area. And so that seems to be the key problem. That other people will show up who don't care for what you're about to espouse. Or it could be the annual meeting of the American Civil Liberty Union, or the Human Rights Watch, or some other group, and then someone would show up. And so that's the problem for us going forward in this country, is to allow, even though you might not like the ACLU, you might not like the American Nazi Party, if you don't like what they say, don't try to hide it. The best way to kill an idea that you don't like is to put some light on it. Let it out. Let these people do their thing. And if it disgusts you, then you'll know full well whether you want to join up with them or not.
And that is really interesting, in order to how we respond. And it's easy, and we hear this, it's kind of almost like a cliche, free speech is fine as long as it's free speech I agree with.
Yeah.
It becomes more and more difficult to allow or condone free speech by those who are hateful and dangerous, mm-hmm, and so
mm-hmm,
forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are. Well, I guess we'd probably, most of us would agree that you can't intentionally scream fire in a theater that's
right.
Crowded theater, that kind of thing.
But for example, in South Africa, I guess it was a news show. I mean, like a radio show, and he was this broadcaster was sitting in at the mic and telling one opposing tribal group where the other opposing tribal group was. And he wasn't there to lead them in this mass killing that was going to take place, but his speech included where they were. So he was tried in court, I suppose he could have said, I have free speech, but it did indeed endanger. It endangered and led to the killing and massacre of these other tribal members.
Well, I think probably in this country, you might be on thin ground if what you were doing was clearly primarily intent to riot, incitement to riot, if that's what you were up to.
Well, excuse me. What about this? In an article that I just read recently, after Trump's talk, anti-immigrant speeches, and then particularly anti-Muslim speeches, attacks on Muslims for the next 7 days skyrocketed 87%. But that would be difficult to say that Trump caused that. But on the other hand, he's the one who's going, it's the Muslims. They're the terrorists. They're doing all of these things. Mm-hmm. And then 87% rise in attacks on Muslims.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And that it's not as though his speech is without a repercussion.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the part of that discussion we had earlier today about whether, you know, a person's prefrontal cortex is fully developed so that they can estimate consequences.
True.
Unlike the teenager, adults are supposed to be able to be a bit better at estimating consequences. And so the idea that if you were, you know, a president, let's say when President Nixon was in trouble, well let's just skip forward to President Trump. He has a lot of people out there who are still in his base, and he can show up in Alabama or in Phoenix or in various places in Iowa, wherever, and have a, it's almost like there's another election, another campaign event going on where he says things that they like to hear. And I think as long as he can keep doing that, he may not lose many of them, because he's been having trouble in his wars at home, his domestic wars,
right,
in trying to get programs through. And I think he's probably, lucky that the Obamacare, the last version of repealing Obamacare, the replacement for Obamacare, the last version of it, had that made it through and had he signed it, and once that got out to the people, and you're talking about 25 to 32 million people would be losing coverage, other people would have seen their rates skyrocket and their coverage limited. He's lucky. He dodged one on that. And so the next issue that may be popping up here is tax reform. President Trump has this, there was one issue that there is a connection between trying to maintain your base until you can actually give them something that you promised, whether it's a wall or health insurance or a job with a middle-class income, and those old jobs, you know, they're gone. They're not coming back. So at any rate, if you can't come through with something that you promised, you need to keep them fired up, or they'll drift. They'll start to fracture. And some of them may end up over here with Bernie Sanders. Others may end up over with a socialist, a clear socialist, which Bernie's not a very good socialist. Anyway, so they may stray to other Republicans, or to Elizabeth Warren. And part of that, his advisors will sense trouble as soon as the Democratic Party rebrands itself. They're now in a flummoxing situation. It's like they're in a room full of feathers or jello and they can't find their way out. But eventually they will, and they'll get somebody, they'll get a corporation. My good friend Phil is a rebrander. Maybe I'll recommend him to them. So at any rate, as soon as they can rebrand themselves, then that will be one more area where some of President Trump's base might be enticed to move over there, since he hasn't produced anything that he promised yet. And I don't see much of a chance of that on the horizon. If you look at, so far, the tax reform proposals, that's not going to do anything for the base. He's using that old Ronald Reagan, Arthur Laffer curve that supply creates its own demand, an old law out of economics, Say's Law, which trickle-down economics is, as President Bush Sr. said when he was running against Reagan for the nomination in 1980, he called Reagan's economics voodoo economics.
That's right.
And it still is. It's been disproven over and over and over again, and these people have sold it to President Trump.
Have they sold it to him, or is he just looking at his billionaire buddies and saying, "Okay, we'll just, yeah, I'll help you guys out."
Yeah,
I don't know.
He may have a better background in econ than I think he does. I don't know much about the school that he went to. Certainly is a big name. Wharton is a big name. I don't know if he actually finished there or whether he went somewhere else. At any rate, we could probably pick this up, at our next program. There are a few things that pop up from time to time, you know, as we look at notable events from past Septembers. I'm switching pages now.
Yes, we hear you, Professor Pollack.
Away from the stumbling.
And we only have maybe a minute and a half left, so we're running out of time.
Left. Okay, I got
soon.
My Timex. Can we advertise like that? Okay. Well, at any rate.
Retract. I'm just kidding.
notable events in past Septembers, 1857 pops up, 9/11 in 1857, oddly enough, same date. Mountain Meadows Massacre in southwestern Utah. The Mormons, for some reason, they got a hunch that there was a wagon train coming through that was not friendly to them. And it was full of people from Arkansas and Alabama, wealthy people that had money, and they had a lot of cattle with them. They were heading to California. They came through that part of Utah in 1857. It wasn't a state yet. It was territory. And they got 140 adults got massacred. For some reason, and still one guy did some time for that in prison. The Mormon leaders, Brigham Young and so forth, they're very unclear whether the church actually sanctioned what these people did. Yeah.
So with that, Professor Pollack, I am sorry, but we're going to have to end our show. It's been a wonderful show, and I want to thank you. You've been listening to Dig This Trump Watch with host Professor Pollack, and I want to thank the listeners and Shane Houchins. And please don't forget our upcoming pledge drive this month. We need your support. We are listener-supported. Goodbye for now.